Let me introduce you to Michael Mann. Michael is a climatologist and one of the top climate scientists in the world. He's a distinguished professor of meteorology at Penn State University and the author of a new book called The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. Michael, welcome to the Big 550.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Let's start with the simplest question. What is, in climate terms, the hockey stick?
Well, it's a curve that my co-authors and I published a decade and a half ago. It's reflective of an effort to reconstruct how the climate changed in the more distant past. We only have about a century or so of widespread thermometer records, and those records tell us that the globe has warmed about a degree and a half Fahrenheit over the past century. But what the instrumental record alone cannot tell us is how unusual is that sort of warming. And so my co-authors and I turned to what we call proxy records. These are natural archives like tree rings and corals and ice cores that tell us something about the ancient climate, and we can use them to piece together the puzzle of how the climate changed in the more distant past. And so this curve that we published again, 15 years ago now, was an estimate of how temperatures around the Earth had varied over the past 1,000 years. And what it showed was that the recent warming really was without precedent. What we're seeing today does not appear consistent with the natural variations in temperature that one sees in the past.
And because that graph was long and flat for a long time and then spiked up in the last few decades, it looked like a hockey stick on its side, and so it became known as the hockey stick graph. That was it?
Yeah, that's right. What it shows is that temperatures were relatively warm about 1,000 years, and then they sort of decline into the depths of the Little Ice Age of the 17th, 18th, 19th century. So you can think of that as this long handle. And then, of course, at the end of the 19th century and then on into the 20th century, we see this rapid warming. And that's sort of like the blade. So if you put the two together, it looks sort of like a hockey stick laid on its side.
Since you and your colleagues came out with that graph 15 years ago, you have become, what you say in the book, you have become the central object of attack in what some have characterized as the best-funded, most carefully orchestrated assault on science the world has known, unquote. Explain that.
Sure. So this graph that we published worked its way into the summary for policymakers of the 2001 IPCC report. So it suddenly became an icon in the climate change debate. It got a name. It got called the hockey stick. It was often presented as a very compelling depiction of the fact that the globe is warming and it is unusual, and by implication, it has something to do with what we're doing. And because of that, it represented a threat to vested interests who find the conclusion that humans are warming the planet by burning fossil fuels very inconvenient, because after all, if you accept that that's the case, then it implies that we do need to do something to shift away from our current reliance on fossil fuels, what former President George W. Bush called our addiction to fossil fuels. And because of that, fossil fuel interests, various front groups advocating for their cause, decided that they needed to discredit this iconic graphic in sort of the cynical belief that if they could do that, they could claim to have undermined the evidence, the reason for concern over human-caused climate change. And because of that, our work, and in fact, even me personally, I have found myself at the center of this much larger, very well-funded, very well-organized campaign of disinformation aimed at discrediting the science of climate change and discrediting the cause for doing something about it.
Michael, in addition to people publishing what you say would be inaccurate information, I mean, what other lengths have people on the other side gone to against you and your staff? Have you ever felt that you personally were in danger?
Sure, just about everything in the book, and I sort of detail the history in my book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. You know, it was sort of what I characterize as a crescendo of attacks. It started out with, you know, somewhat bad faith criticisms of our work that appeared in op-eds in often conservative leading news outlets or talk radio. Eventually, we found ourselves at the center of attacks by prominent politicians who were closely allied with fossil fuel interests, like Joe Barton, who was the chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee back in 2005. He attempted to subpoena all of my personal emails, every scrap of paper from my entire scientific career, in an effort, you know, to essentially to discredit me. Unfortunately, members of his own party, like the Science Committee chair, Sherwood Bollert, a Republican from New York, sharply condemned what he saw as an effort to intimidate scientists whose findings might be, you know, inconvenient to the special interests that fund his campaigns. John McCain actually also came out and defended us against the attacks of his fellow Republican. Then, you know, some years later, the maverick, some would call him a Tea Party Attorney General, Ken Cuccinelli, the Attorney General of Virginia, basically took that page from the Joe Barton playbook and tried to use his authority as the Attorney General of Virginia to demand all of my personal emails from the time that I was at the University of Virginia. And again, the object was fairly clear. What they've hoped is that they can comb through personal emails and find single words or phrases to use to misrepresent and smear scientists, to embarrass scientists, and frankly to intimidate scientists so they retreat from the public sphere. I've also been object of death threats, some of them actionable enough that the FBI had to investigate them. I've been called every name in the book. I've had nasty emails and letters sent. I had a package, an envelope arrive in the mail that had white powder in it, and the FBI had to send it off to a lab to test it to make sure that neither I nor my colleagues had been exposed to a dangerous substance. So it seems that there are no length that, you know, climate change policy opponents aren't willing to take to try to intimidate and silence climate scientists. And I've pretty much seen it all.
And at one point, you were called names like the Jerry Sandusky of climate science for molesting and torturing data. I mean, it just got completely out of control.
Sure.
And in cases like Cuccinelli, who's now running for governor,
that's right,
of Virginia, did you have to go to court to stop him? Or you know, I know you said that Sherwood Bollert, one Republican, was able to stop another one in Congress, Joe Barton.
Right.
What was able to keep Cuccinelli from getting his hands on all of your stuff, considering he's the attorney general of that state?
Yep. Well, fortunately, you know, the University of Virginia fought back. They realized, and in fact, even conservative interests in Virginia spoke out against this because they recognized that it was a very dangerous precedent that this would set. And it doesn't even matter what your politics are, whether they're conservative or liberal. The idea that an attorney general who doesn't like your ideas, if you're an academic or a scientist who's opposed to your ideas, could use abuse, I should say, his authority to go after you, to engage in a you know, a witch hunt, an open-ended witch hunt, an effort to intimidate and discredit. That's a scary prospect. That's something that I think pretty much all Americans can agree is not good. And again, it doesn't matter what your politics are. So fortunately, a lot of different groups, some of them even conservative groups, came out and denounced Cuccinelli's effort to, you know, to discredit me, to attack the University of Virginia, Thomas Jefferson's great university. And fortunately, the University of Virginia fought back in court. Cuccinelli was defeated in the lower court based on the fact that he hadn't provided any evidence whatsoever of wrongdoing or indiscretion on my part. He actually challenged it then to the state Supreme Court, which just about a year and a half ago, or almost 2 years ago, rejected the case with prejudice, meaning that they really didn't want to ever see their attorney general come back to the court with something like that again. So fortunately, you know, we prevailed, but the attacks continue. And there are many other scientists who may not be as prominent as I am, and may not have the same, you know, resources and defenders who can come to the table to defend the science when under attack. There are many other colleagues of mine who have been subject to, you know, Freedom of Information Act demands, various other attacks, efforts by fossil fuel front groups to intimidate them, to embarrass them. Unfortunately, it's sort of part of the job description if you're a climate scientist in today's world.
Michael, have you talked to some of these people and they've told you, you know what, we backed off on something because we don't want to go through what Michael Mann is going through?
Well, they don't even have to tell me that because we know that that's what's happening. We know that that's the intent. And yes, I have actually heard young scientists who have said, hey, look, you know, my university is giving in to this demand by this industry group to turn over all of my personal emails. I think it's without question that that does have a chilling effect. It is causing scientists to second guess themselves when they, you know, have to make a decision. Well, should I go into this field where, you know, depending on my findings, I might be subject to an attack by an attorney general or a fossil fuel industry front group? Or should I go into this other area of science, which, you know, is uncontroversial and, you know, doesn't have policy implications, and I can just sort of be alone in my lab doing what I love doing, which is science? You know, the fear is that scientists will increasingly choose that latter course. And what it means is that the best scientists that we have won't be going into critical areas of science, be it climate change or stem cell research or evolutionary biology or any of the other areas of science where there are policy implications and there are those who would not like to see the science be done or get funded.
Michael, I will not even begin to try to say that I understand the extent of your research as a climatologist. I mean, this is something you have dedicated your life to. And I'm curious, how many times have you found yourself in a conversation with opponents trying to throw out these scientific terms or trying to understand this to the degree that you do, and you're thinking you have no idea what you're talking about?
Well, there is a lot of pseudoscience out there, and there's a lot of anti-science. And that's something that science has always dealt with. There are people, there are organizations and causes that, for whatever reason, find the implications of science a threat, find them intimidating, and they have done much to attack the science, be it, you know, evolutionary biology or, you know, the effect of, you know, the impacts of environmental contaminants or pharmaceutical, possible effects of pharmaceutical products or climate change. And so sometimes as a scientist in an area like this, there's so much misinformation that's out there, and some of it is out there intentionally. Some of it has been put out there by special interests who want to cloud the discussion because they realize that all they need to do is to confuse the public. They don't have to win the issue. They don't have to prove their case. They just have to cast enough doubt on the science to convince the public and policymakers that there isn't an adequate enough framework to base policy on. And so you see this, you know, there's a lot of misinformation and disinformation that's out there. Some of it, you know, many of those who, you know, think that climate change is controversial or think that there isn't a scientific consensus are, in my view, victims of a larger disinformation campaign. They're not the bad guys. A lot of the confused members of the public are the victims as much as anyone else. And as scientists, we have to do our best to understand that when they, you know, when they espouse unscientific beliefs, much of that is because they've been brainwashed, they've been fed propaganda, and we have to do our best to try to not only, you know, provide them good scientific information, but provide them with resources, places they can turn to, where they can get reliable information so that they're not as prone to these very well-funded, pervasive disinformation efforts. And so as a scientist, I see it as my role, in part, to do as much as I can do to inform the discourse, to try to educate those who are confused about what the science has to say.
I want to ask you, speaking of people's doubts being raised about this, and I know that there is scientific consensus on this, and any doubts are, as you say, essentially being ginned up by deniers and people from the industries that would be impacted by changes that we would necessarily need to make to fight the climate change. But I'd like you to talk for a moment here about something that happened in 2009, which I think probably did a lot to raise doubts in people's minds, or maybe even put an asterisk next to the whole question of climate change. And that was when some emails between climate scientists, and maybe you were one of them, went back and forth and were excerpted in various places, particularly right. online. And it talked about tricks that scientists were using or well, you fill me in on exactly sure. what happened, if you would. But I know you're familiar with that word, tricks.
Yeah. Well, so it was part of this ongoing campaign, this crescendo of attacks, and this particular episode happened in the weeks leading up to what was likely to be the greatest opportunity ever for meaningful progress on climate change policy, the Copenhagen summit of December 2009. And so in the lead up to that, and maybe it's a coincidence, but most likely not, there was a massive disinformation campaign that was launched, and it very much appeared to be an effort to thwart the discussion, to hijack the discussion, and to thwart the possibility of progress in Copenhagen. And what it was thousands of emails that had been stolen from a university server in the UK, and then individual words and phrases were, as you say, excerpted from these emails and taken out of context and then put up on TV screens and blasted around the sort of the denialist regions of the internet. And it bubbled up into a sort of mainstream media story. But the story, the real story, should have been this cynical criminal act aimed at discrediting climate scientists and thwarting climate policy. But instead, by and large, the media bought into the framing of the climate change deniers. And there was a very well-funded, very well-organized public relations campaign that was launched to try to make it sound like when these scientists had used the term trick, as you allude to, that, oh, look, they were trying to play a trick on the American public about climate change because it's actually a massive hoax. When in fact, as you probably know, as a science savvy person, or both of you, the term trick is used by mathematicians and physicists and scientists to denote a clever approach to solving a problem, to solving a difficult or vexatious problem. And that's the sense in which trick was being used in that one email. But it was taken out of context, cynically misrepresented in a way to try to fool the public. And unfortunately, a somewhat uncritical media bought right into that narrative. And so we had this completely specious scandal that came to be known as ClimateGate when, you know, several years later now and more than a half dozen different investigations in the U.S. and the U.K., we now know there was no evidence of any impropriety on the part of the scientists in any of these emails. Ironically, the only wrongdoing was the criminal theft of those emails in the first place.
It sounds to me like the word trick in that context is the same thing when a mathematician can use a shortcut to figure out a square root. The fact that they're doing it with a mathematical trick doesn't mean that there's no such thing as square roots.
Very well put.
Michael, you talked about Copenhagen being a missed opportunity, and several years ago we also did not sign on to the Kyoto protocols.
Right.
What do you see as happening in the near future when it comes to fighting climate change?
Another great question. The rest of the world is already starting to act, even in the absence of a binding climate policy, international climate policy, which is to say that countries like China who are an increasingly important contributor, of course, and now the greatest producer of greenhouse gas emissions in the world. And yet, they are way ahead of the U.S. in terms of the amount of funding that they are putting into renewable energy. And they are way ahead of the U.S. in terms of the commitment that they are willing to make to meaningful climate policy. In China, they're talking about instituting a carbon tax, a way of what we say internalizing the costs to the planet of fossil fuel burning. When we emit a ton of carbon into the atmosphere, we're doing damage. We're doing damage to the environment. We're doing damage to ourselves, to our economy, to our food resources, to our water resources, all of the things that are negatively impacted by climate change. And so if we are to make sensible choices in how we get our energy, we have to build into the economic process that cost. We have to level the playing field so that cost is internalized. And there are various vehicles for doing that, and there's a worthy political debate to be had about what sort of ways, what sort of policies we should put in place to internalize that cost. And there are conservatives, for example, who argue that we need a revenue-neutral tax. That's a free market way of solving this problem. And I think that's a worthy debate. But there is no room for debate about whether the problem exists. And unfortunately, the U.S. Congress is still stuck in that unworthy debate. We have a House Science Committee that doesn't accept the science of climate change. The leadership, the Republican leadership, doesn't accept the science of climate change. They don't accept the science of evolution. I've joked at times we ought to rename them the House Anti-Science Committee, because that's what they seem like at times. But the rest of the world is moving ahead. And the question is, are we going to fall behind? Are we going to let the rest of the world move ahead, recognizing that, you know, a clean energy economy is the way of the future? Are we going to fall behind in our competitiveness because we let other countries move ahead of us? Hopefully, we won't. And hopefully, we'll see some significant changes, perhaps in our congressional, the makeup of our Congress over the next few years, so that there will be the possibility of passing meaningful climate legislation here in the U.S. In the absence of that possibility, right now, of course, the president is taking executive actions to try to deal with climate change. But there's only so much you can do at the executive level. We do need a comprehensive climate and energy plan to pass our Congress.
Michael Mann is one of the world's top climatologists, a climate scientist who is also a distinguished professor of meteorology at Penn State University. The book is called The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. Michael, it's been a pleasure having you on today. Thanks so much for your time.
It's a pleasure for me. Thanks.